My name is Ellen, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi,
so let's have a meeting. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight we have Christopher coming from you guys traveling down here in the rain from Gainesville to support him. And I hear he's got a fantastic and hilarious story. So let's welcome Christopher.
Thank you so much. My name is Christopher. I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you.
I hope we're talking about the same Christopher. And so, I come from the Coming Group. I'm going to take this jacket off. Here I am already in public taking my clothes off, you know. Got to start early. Yeah. First of all, it's a great honor and privilege to do this. This is probably the best Christmas present I could have asked for. You know, today has been a truly AA impactful day. You know, this afternoon at noon, I was asked to be discussion leader at the Hulk Club. So there I am, one meeting, I'm a discussion leader, and the next meeting, I'm telling my story. So it's been a pretty big AA-involved day. And for that, I'm thankful, because it's the best thing I got going on. And so, and I'm thankful for Tim. I'm glad he's in Hawaii, and it's amazing. We were emailing back and forth. He's actually telling his story right now, tonight, in Hawaii. So I know he can. So I'm taking his spot here, and he's still telling his story over there. So hopefully he's enjoying that, and not get too much sand in his shoes. But you know, it's sad to say, this is my first time to this group. You know, it's been such a wonderful big group, and I've driven past it probably 100 times, and I've never stopped here. I know I spent some time at the Triangle Group. The Triangle is where I picked up several white chips. Well, if one's good, more is better, right? And I'm feeling kind of nostalgic. You know, so it was 89 and a half years ago. And I want to read this. It says, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Tonight, I will share my story and add to those thousands. But in addition to that, I wanted to, on page 155, it gives us the start of this whole thing. You know, we know when Bill was making those phone calls, trying to find another alcoholic to help in that Mayflower Hotel lobby, he finally got in touch with Dr. Bob. And the whole power of this thing was that Bill showed up not to talk about Bob's drinking, but to talk to Bob about Bill's drinking. And I'm not here I'm here tonight to share my experience. And so this was the experience 89 and a half years ago in June 1934. And this is Bill. His call to the clergyman led him presently to a certain resident of that town. That's Dr. Bob, who, though formerly able and respected, was then nearing the nadir of the alcoholic despair. It was a usual situation. Home in jeopardy, wife ill, children distracted, bills in arrear, and standing damaged. He had a desperate desire to stop, but saw no way out, for he had earnestly tried many avenues of escape. Painfully aware of being somehow abnormal, the man did not fully realize what it meant to be alcoholic. And this refers to Bill's first visit with Dr. Bob. These men later became the co-founders of AA. Bill's story opens the text of this book, and Dr. Bob's story heads the story section. And it goes on to say, when our friend related his experience, that's referring to Bill, the man agreed that no amount of willpower might muster could stop his drinking for long. A spiritual experience, he conceded, was absolutely necessary. but the price seemed high upon the basis suggested. He told how he lived in constant worry about those he might find out about his alcoholism. He had, of course, the familiar alcoholic obsession that few knew of his drinking. Why, he argued, should he lose the remainder of his business, only to bring still more suffering to his family by foolishly admitting his plight to people from whom he had made his livelihood. He would do anything, he said, but that. Being intrigued, however, he invited our friend to his home some time later, and just as he thought he was getting control of his liquor situation, he went on a roaring bender. For him, this was the spree that ended all sprees. He saw that he would have to face his problems squarely, that God might give him mastery. You know, and this is, why am I reading this? Because it's sharing my experience so well. It continues, one morning he took the bull by the horns. I didn't realize they talked like that back in the 30s. Grabbing the bull by the horns. You know? He set out to tell those he feared that his trouble had been. He found himself surprisingly well received and learned that many knew of his drinking, of course. Stepping into his car, he made the rounds of people he had hurt. He trembled as he went about, for this might mean ruin, particularly to the person in his line of business. At midnight, he came home exhausted, but very happy. He had not had a drink since. And this is referring to Dr. Bob, and this is June 10th, 1935, 89 and a half years ago. As we shall see, he now means a great deal to his community, and the major liabilities of 30 years of hard drinking have been repaired in four. That sounds like a pretty wonderful promise to me. God doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. But life was not easy for the two friends. Plenty of difficulties presented themselves. Both saw that they must keep spiritually active. One day they called up the head nurse of a local hospital. They explained their need and inquired if she had a first-class alcoholic prospect. She replied, yes, we've got a corker. He's just beating up a couple nurses. Goes off his head completely when he's drinking. But he's a grand chap when he's sober. Though he's been in here 8 times in the last 6 months. Understand he was once a well-known lawyer in this town. But just now we've got him strapped down tight. And, of course, this is referring to Bill Dotson, alcoholic number 3, otherwise known as the man on the bed. He was a prospect, all right, but by the description, none too promising. The use of spiritual principles in such cases was not so well understood as it is now. But one of the friends said, put him in a private room, we'll be down. 2 days later, Detox, a future fellow of Alcoholics Anonymous, stared glassily at the strangers beside his bed. Who are you fellas? And why this private room? I've always been in a ward before, said one of the visitors. We're giving you a treatment for alcoholism. Hopeless was written large on the man's face as he replied, oh, but that's no use. Nothing would fix me. I'm a goner. The last 3 times, I got drunk on the way home from here. I'm afraid to go out of the door. I can't understand it. For an hour, the two friends told him about their drinking experiences. Over and over, he would say, yes, that's me, that's me, I drink like that. The man in the bed was told of the acute poisoning from which he suffered, how it deteriorates the body of the alcoholic and warps his mind. There was much talk about the mental state preceding the first drink. Yes, that's me, the sick man said, the very image. You fellas know your stuff, all right. But I don't see what a good it'll do. You fellas are somebody. I was once, but I'm a nobody now. From what you tell me, I know more than ever I can't stop. At this, both the visitors burst into a laugh. Said the future fellow Anonymous, damn little to laugh about that I can see. The two friends spoke of their spiritual experience, told him about the course of action they carried out. He interrupted, I used to be a strong for the church, but that won't fix it. I prayed to God on hangover mornings and sworn that I'd never touch another drop, but by 9 o'clock, I'd be bold as an owl. The next day found the prospect more receptive. He had been thinking it over. Maybe you're right, he said. God ought to be able to do anything. Then he added, he sure didn't do much for me when I was trying to fight booze in this racket alone. On the third day, the lawyer gave his life to the care and direction of his Creator. He said he was perfectly willing to do anything necessary. His wife came scarcely daring to the hospital to be hopeful, though she thought she saw something different about her husband already. He had begun to have a spiritual experience. That afternoon, he put on his clothes and walked from the hospital a free man. He entered a political campaign, making speeches, frequenting men's gathering places of all sorts, often staying up all night. He lost the race by only a narrow margin, but he had found God, and in finding God, he had found himself. That was June 1935. He never drank again. June 26, 1935, to be exact. 75 years later, I would pick up my white chip. June 26, 2010. I was in a clubhouse in Atlanta. I've always felt a connection to this story, so that's why I read it. Because we share the same sobriety date. You know, so thankfully I had a friend of mine. When I was 18 years old, I graduated high school. Actually, 19. So I graduated high school in Cumming, Georgia from Forsyth Central High School. 2006, class of 2006. I barely graduated. I failed my English class. My senior, second semester of senior year, I failed. I had to stay behind. As everyone else went on a class field trip and do a special book report just so I could pass. But somehow I passed my Spanish class with an A. So Spanish was an A, English was an F. I really struggled in school because I found alcohol, you know. My very first drink, you know, so my mom married her divorce attorney. So I experienced things with him that we didn't grow up with. So when my mom married him, it was a new world, you know, like, what do you mean we get to live in a house? Like, we've always lived in an apartment, you know, what do you mean a boat on the lake? You know, what, you know, all these things I've never experienced before, including his bottle of Grey Goose vodka underneath the cabinet, like right here, here's a refrigerator, underneath the cabinet, there's a big old bottle of Grey Goose vodka. And at that time, I was working at CC's Pizza. I'm a pizza, you know, I'm a pizza guy. And so I can't tell you, I was probably 16 or so because I was driving at that point. And I got home from work, I'm pretty sure. I don't know where my family was doing that night, but I was like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it tonight. I went over to the kitchen, got me a big old highball glass, you know, and I set it down. And now this is why I'm not alcoholic. Because Grey Goose did not put a serving size on the bottle. There's no serving size. How much do you pour? I don't know. This is my first time I've ever... So I just pour it like I'm pouring a sick soda. Pour a full glass. And then I'm like... I've seen people with chasers, so I get some ginger ale. A second glass of some ginger ale. And I chug, you know, half of that 8-ounce shot of vodka. Run around the kitchen like a chicken because my throat is burning so bad. I've never felt anything like it before. My throat was burning so bad with all that vodka. And I don't know if this is my obsession, my craving already kicking in, or another obsession. You know, I've always struggled with the idea of letting things go to waste. It's probably why at the age of 15, I was 199 pounds with a 44-inch waist. I was a hefty old boy, you know, shopping in the men's clothes at the department store. I can remember the lady at the department store saying, you know, we got a kids section. I'm like, yeah, I tried there. you know, here I am trying to buy pants in the men's section at 14 years old. Getting back to the liquor. I'm like, I got to finish it. I just went through the pain of the burning sensation. There's no need for me to finish that glass. But yet, I'm like, I got to finish it. So that's exactly what I do. And then I sit down and I go back to the living room. I'm like, well, I'm glad that's over. And I just sit down and I just wait. I'm not sure what to expect. I have no idea what's coming. I didn't find out, obviously, till the next morning. When I was basically covered in my dinner from the night before. You know, my bed was soiled with projectile vomiting. And my mom said she could hear me through the night just regurgitating. So I'm assuming to some extent I had some level of alcohol poisoning. But because I'm so stubborn and I still woke up the next morning and went to work. Not really sure what just happened the night before. Yeah, that was my first drink. I still don't know why did I feel the need to finish it. Like my friend David says, well, you know, the cart's already in the ditch. We don't need to figure out how it got there. Just get it out, you know. And then the second time drinking, like Bill's story, I was part of life at last. there was a beautiful girl in my school. She was actually dating my friend. So I moved to Cumming, Georgia from upstate New York at the age of 15. I started my freshman year in high school at Greece Athena High School in Greece, New York. All of our schools were named after Greek gods. So I went to Apollo Middle School and then Athena High School. It was a really nice small town. You know, I rode my bike to school every year since the fifth grade. You know, and I was in elementary school riding my bike to school. I was a kid who would stop at the bakery on the way home riding my bike, you know, back to grandma's house. It was a great, you know, I enjoyed it. Sometime around the year 2000, I was 12 or 13. My mom called me up one day. She's like, I've decided to move to Atlanta, Georgia. I'm like, well, okay. I'm like, all right. I'm not really sure where that is. So after I hang up the phone with my mom, I get out my globe. You know, I'm one of those kids who had a globe. So I'm like, where's Atlanta? And I find it, and I'm like, wow, that's pretty far, Georgia. I'm like, why is she going all the way down there for? You know, obviously, my parents were separated. So, you know, that happened in the year 2000. She decides to move to Atlanta with my two half-brothers. So me and my sister up in New York are living with our father. And so for those 2.5, 3 years, we traveled back and forth every so often, like in the summer and I think Christmas. Wow. So here we are at Christmas again. The Christmas of 2003, me and my sister flew back up to New York. And we did not want to go back up to New York. We loved it here. And so at the airport, me and my sister are both crying. We don't want to go back to New York. We want to stay here in Georgia with our mom and brothers. And, of course, this new life my stepdad has provided, you know, all this, wow, house. She makes the decision. As we get on the plane, she drives home, packs up a load in the car, gets my brothers, and they follow us up. So they drive up to New York, December 28th or whatever. So it's... And then we rent a U-Haul trailer, and me and my sister decided to move down here that night. But it was, at the age of 15, it was very difficult because here I am one night. I'm in upstate Greece, New York, snowing. It's upstate New York. What do you expect? My dad, a police officer, my mom, and me are all standing in my room. I'm 15 years old. Legally deciding which parent I want to live with. Do I want to stay living with my father or make the move to move to Atlanta with my mother? I make a decision, we're moving to Atlanta. And then so then I proceed to pack everything I have in the black trash bags. Here I'm 15 years old, packing everything I own in the black trash bags, throwing them down the stairs while they're being loaded up into a U-Haul and I'm leaving everything I can't carry behind. 15, you know, what 15-year-old is supposed to do that? And I was born and raised Jehovah's Witness. So, my dad, he's experienced in AA. But growing up, shortly thereafter I was born, he got involved with the Jehovah's Witness religion. So for the next 15 years, I was raised Jehovah's Witness inside the Kingdom Hall. You know, that's why at the time, I hated it. I'm like, why do I have to go to Kingdom Hall 4 times a week? Why do I have to go to unassigned? You know, we would go to Kentucky and West Virginia and Tennessee and do all this unassigned territory work and then go to these conventions and then have to... I'm the kid at 8 years old knocking on your door on Saturday morning, and we even had to call like a little joke called knuckleitis, because when you knock on so many screen doors, your knuckles turn white, you know, from all the white coming off the screen door. And I'm like, why do I have to do this, you know? Why don't I get to participate in stuff at the school? You know, like everyone in school is participating in extracurricular stuff. Why don't I get to participate in that? So it started to train me that isolation was appropriate because I'm not supposed to participate at all. You're a non-believer. I'm not supposed to talk to you. You know, so it made me feel like isolation was key. So that carried forward a decade, plus some alcohol, jackpot, you know. then there I am. Going back to one of the blessings of my stepfather, he had a condo in Buckhead. So when one day after I graduated high school, I was working at a gas station in Buford, Georgia, which I thought was awesome. I was like, man, this is awesome. I'm working at a gas station near Lake Lanier. This is incredible. I'm 19 years old. But basically, I guess him and my mom said, you got to go to college or start paying us rent. So I decided to enroll in culinary school. So I went to Le Cordon Bleu in Tucker, Georgia. My stepdad had a condo in Buckhead. So rather than making the drive from Tucker to Cumming every day, twice a day, which was a chaotic drive, I decided to move to his condo in Buckhead, which was really was my little cave. Mm-hmm. Even though I was in culinary school, I was working on my career of alcoholism. you know, I barely graduated culinary school. There I am. At one point in school, I'm the high honor roll student. I'm the kid with perfect attendance. I'm the teacher's pet. You know, I'm the kid. And then here I am, struggling to finish high school, struggling to finish culinary school. You know, like the big book says, we build up this bright life for others to see, like, look, you know, and then we tear it all down. You know, when I started culinary school, I was like in the top of the class. You know, one of the top restaurateurs in this city, Atlanta, went to the school and said, I need your best students. I was one of the six she sent out of 900. And then there I am struggling to graduate. But in that condo, I lived for 4 years. And man, it was part awesome and part torture, the alcoholic torture. It was awesome because I'm 19 years old. My ego was through the roof, you know? Here I am, 19 years old, living in a condo in Buckhead. I got a souped-up Honda Prelude. You know, it's got a bottle of nitrous in the trunk, you know? Not that I ever figured out how to work it, you know? You know, the people at the bar would call me Paul Walker. You know, that was my nickname. And having my culinary experience, I started working with, an awesome catering company. And then this is kind of where, practicing the 12th tradition of anonymity. Not only do I protect alcoholics inside of AA, keep that in AA, but I also have to protect non-alcoholics and keep them out of my story. You know, it's kind of like when you see a TV show, names have been changed to protect the identity of those involved. You know, I have to be very careful not to, they're living their life. You know, I'm not dragging them into my story, but they are involved. It's my story, you know. At that catering company, there I am. I'm a part of life at last. I'm living in the condo, rent-free, because I'm going to school. I got the car, and now I got this awesome job that allows me to cater in these mansions all throughout town. So a couple years ago, I'm in upstate New York, in Greece, New York, a town of 40,000 people. And now I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, downtown, I had no idea this level of life existed. That really got to my head pretty quick. My stepdad found out I had about $40,000 in student loans, because that's how much it costs for 1 year of culinary school. $40,000, more than it costs to go to Harvard. So he was like, well, why don't we take out a loan using the condo as collateral, because that'll be a lower interest rate. You can use that money, pay off the student loan, and then just pay off the loan for the condo. I'm like, okay, sounds pretty good. Then comes alcoholism. Here I am, 19, 18 years old, 19, with $40,000 in my checking account. Mm. And at this point, I'm starting to get warmed up to the idea of some dry goods that go along with alcohol. My best thinking was to quit my job so that I could do drugs full time. And so that's exactly what I proceeded to do over the next 18 months. I quit my job at that catering company I loved so much. And I actually budgeted pretty well, you know, $40,000 in a year and a half. That's pretty moderate, you know. And I was telling people around me, you know, for 3 months or so of that, a friend of mine bought a farm down in Orange Beach, Alabama. That was a great time, you know. So he rented a house on Ono Island for a week for his family. You know, he's a successful businessman, so he invited me down to go with him. And then I told him I did really well, and I had a lot of money saved up, so I didn't have to work. That was my lie, you know. So people are like, why aren't you working? You know, I've done really well, and I'm taking some time off. I'm semi-retiring at the age of 19. What? Yeah, that later on, that became a financial amends. And that part of life at last. So my second drink, I'm hanging out with people from school, and I get invited to a party from the girl of my dreams. I'm like, yes. It was the most wonderful night. At least I thought. We go up to a quick trip, up and coming. We fill up, you know, we get those ghost slushies that we later bring back to the house and mix with tequila. And man, there is my second drunk. drinking tequila with the girl of my dreams, who is dating my friend, so I can't do anything, you know. I get so drunk, and we're drinking out of this fishbowl. So it's like this fishbowl glass. We just pour everything in, and we're just passing it around like this communion thing, you know. And so I'm drinking it, and then I'm so drunk later on, they have an actual fishbowl with the same glass. And I take the actual fishbowl and drink that and swallow some goldfish. And the only reason I know that is because later in the next morning when I'm having to clean the bathroom, there is goldfish everywhere I projectile vomited, you know? So that was a horrible experience. So there I am. My first two drunks end the exact same way. But yet, that doesn't stop me. It just continues on. But, you know, thankfully, I guess that's for the benefit of loaned money and some dry goods come into play. They really speed up the power of alcoholism. Because, you know, the big book at one point talks about the drinker at some point may be able to stop if a strong enough power comes into play. You know, as I was in culinary school, I was dating a girl, another dream situation. Wow, this girl actually wants to date me. But she was like, I'm not going to hang out with you if you're drinking and smoking. Deal. Done. Cold turkey. Just like that. I'm done.
Yeah.
You know? You're more important. I'm done. And then that lasts a couple months after I find out she has two other boyfriends as well. So I politely text her one day. I'm like, can you stop storing your stuff at my condo and not be there when I get back? That ended that. Fast forward, not that much longer, 6-9 months. Here I am at that catering job, a job I love more than that girl. I love that job. It was my identity. I'm a workaholic. I get my identity through my work. I'm sitting there with the owner of the company. He's asking me, what do I want to do? I'm like, I need to quit. The power of alcohol had already taken over. Alcoholism was more important to me than that job. So that's kind of like, you know, the progression of alcoholism. At one point, I had the power to decide when I would drink, and then I lost it. You know, and then my very last drink, my little sister, she passed away about 17 years ago of a brain. Well, she was diagnosed 17 years ago, passed away about 15 years ago with a brain tumor at the age of 17. And then at her funeral, of course, me being the alcoholic, drug addict big brother, I make sure I bury her with some dry goods and some alcohol. So I put a bottle of champagne, we buried her with a bottle of champagne, and I packed her a bowl, you know. I'm like, what? You know, what? So, but then I had another bottle of that champagne. At this point, I have about 2.5 years experience in and out of AA. So at this point, I'm 22. You know, I've been coming in and out of AA for like 2.5 years, fumbling through. You know, I picked up a white chip after every chip except the blue chip. It seems like every time I would come in, I would be able to get less and less time. Like the first time I came in, it was 9 months, right? You know, and then I relapsed, and I was like, shoot, you know, it was a struggle. And then I couldn't even stay sober 2 days. But that last drink, a friend of mine at work gave me this little tiny pill, and I was like, he was going all bizarre about it. He like hit it in the cap of my permanent marker, and then he handed me the permanent marker. I'm like, dude, just give me the pill. Like, what are you, like, why all this mysterious stuff? And so that night, I'm like, yeah, let's see what this little pill does. So I took that pill, and then I went to bed. Went to bed. It was just another normal day, you know. I was going to go to work tomorrow. But then suddenly the thought crossed my mind. I got that bottle of champagne. But I had no intention of ever drinking it. I was going to bury myself with that bottle. That night, I cracked the top of that bottle of champagne. And this, you know, you talk about the powerlessness of alcoholism. I did not want to drink that night. Every sip of alcohol felt like torture. Every sip of alcohol did not yield the desired result. It was the worst drinking experience of my life. I couldn't get drunk even though I was drinking more and more. I don't know how it worked, like, but the gas station was still selling beer and wine at like 3 a.m. I don't know what was going on back then. But like, so I made 2 trips back and forth to that gas station to get more beer and wine, and it was so miserable because all I wanted was some vodka, but there was no place to buy any. So I'm like suffering with this beer and wine. I'm like, this stuff is, ugh. You know that when you drink, the more wine you drink, the thirstier you get, but you can't drink anymore? You know, it's like all those tannins, you know? It's so bizarre. And then I called up my drug dealer, and I get some more dry goods. And then this is another dumb idea I've had. I gave him a house key. Why would I give my drug dealer a house key? I have no idea. That would come into play 2 nights later. But in the morning, I didn't sleep at all. But I'm like, I still got to go to work. I'm driving down Roswell Road, one hand, you know, driving my Chevy Lumina, you know. Long way from that Honda Prelude all souped up, you know. This car my stepdad owns that I paid him back for. So there I am, pulling up to work. And thankfully, at that very moment, maybe this is God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, I don't know. That very moment, I pull up to work, there's another chef outside saying, hey man, you look like you can't, you know, let me get the boss. And so he goes up and gets the boss. They're like, you can't come in the building. You know, if you come in the building, we're going to have to do some extra stuff and get security involved and stuff. It's like, what do you want to do? So at that point, you know, with 2.5 years experience of AA, I'm like, I need AA. So one of the chefs drives me back home. I make it to the meeting that day and pick up my last white chip. You know, that was June 26, 2010. Which was amazing because my strategy was to have a cool sobriety birthday. You know, I want to be cool. You know, I'm unique, you know. So I got sober on Cinco de Mayo. I'm like the alcoholic Olympics, you know. If I'm going to have a holiday, I'm going to be sober, it's going to be Cinco de Mayo. And by golly, I did it. Cinco de Mayo 2010, I chose that to be my sobriety day. I stayed sober. And then I got drunk on the 6th. I'm like... So then, you know, this might have zero value, but here we come to June 26th, the 75th anniversary of AA's first group, Bill, Bob, and Bill. June 26th, 1934. There they are. Here I am, 75 years later, getting sober on that anniversary. That might have zero value. I don't know, but I think it's pretty cool. You know, God doing for me what I can't do for myself. You know, there's no spiritual side to the program because it's all spiritual. But then it takes me becoming aware to it. You know, the most important word in the 10th step of conscious contact is I have to be conscious. So that money I borrowed, stole from my stepdad, it's kind of like a double whammy amends. And this is probably one of the most powerful experiences I've had in my life. Sometime at about 2 years sober, you know, this is my big book. It's all falling apart. Sometime around 2 years sober, year and a half, I was at a meeting listening to this guy tell his story. And man, this story was like, this guy's incredible. And then he comes up to me after the meeting. I'm like, what's going on here? He's like, hey, do you have anyone taking you through the steps? I'm like, well, he's like, I don't want to be your sponsor. I'm like, oh, okay. He's like, but do you have anyone taking you through the book? I'm like, no, not really. He's like, well, let's do it. You know, we went through this book, and he had me write my name, my sobriety date, and the first time I went through the book, in this book. And can I tell you, that was the hardest thing for me to do, because I am going back to that perfect attendance, high honor roll student. I never wrote in any of my books. All my books were pristine. You know, I took my notes and wrote them elsewhere. I'm like, I can't write my name in my book, you know. But it made it personal. But then it's also embarrassing because I got sober June 26th, but the first time I went through the literature was February 6, 2012. Nearly 18 months. What was I doing? I'm sure I owe some amends to the groups I was going through in that time. You know, I can't imagine what I was doing to those early groups, you know. So we get to the 9th step, and I owe this money to my stepdad. At this point, my little sister's passed away. I've been a horrible big brother. I was supposed to be my big brother, my little sister's hero. I was supposed to be her guardian and protector. And I was her biggest freaking bully, man. And even though I believe I made amends for it, you still don't have that one-on-one, you know. So here I am. I owe this money to my stepdad. I quit my job. Because months before, I'm egotistical. I joined a network marketing company, and I'm going to make $1 million selling coffee. You know, I'm the world's worst salesperson, and yet I'm making my living selling today. So I couldn't sell dry goods, and I couldn't sell coffee. Two of the most consumed products in the world, and I couldn't sell them. Primarily because I used them all myself. There was nothing left to sell. So I quit my job. I'm sitting there sober, miserable, terrible twos, I guess. But on the outside, I got looked like it. You know, I stole a Christian Dior suit out of my stepdad's closet that fit me real well. So here I am walking into AA meetings wearing my stepdad's Christian Dior suit, driving a BMW 740 IL. You know, this is a big boy. Let alone the check engine light's on, but you guys can't see that, and the air conditioning doesn't work, so I'm sweating on the inside. But on the outside, it all looks like I got it going on, even though I'm miserable on the inside. For some reason, I decided to move from that condo in Buckhead back to my stepdad's house in Cumming, Georgia. So I'm a year and a half sober, living back with my mom after this experience of living in Buckhead for 4 years, and I'm just like, what is going on? And then we blot out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we can. I was using everything under the sun except alcohol and drugs. If I joked around and said, if Golden Corral had a membership, I would buy the first one. You know, I was binge eating food like crazy. You know, I remember, you know, that's another precursor to alcoholism. I feel like my alcoholism had a progression. You know, before I actually got to alcohol, there were many other obsessions. You know, one of them was food. You know, I remember going to the doctor at 15 or 16. You know, I would binge and purge, and I was anorexic. So I had those two things going on. He's like, we don't really see this in teenage boys, but here I am, doc. You know, so that was another thing I learned. So there I am, falling back to those old behaviors, and a year and a half sober, binging and purging in my mom's basement. After have living that wonderful life down in Buckhead. Like, what are you doing, dude? Left to my own devices, I sincerely struggle. Well, we get to this 9-step. My solution is to take my BMW and drive it as fast as I can into some brick wall, or go jump off a spaghetti junction, or do something. You know, my solution is to commit suicide. I got 10 cents in my pocket. I'm eating dog food out of my mom's pantry. I'm sober and miserable. Nothing is going on. I've torn down the life I thought I was building. And my sponsor's like, why don't you pray about it? Why don't you pray about it? So one day after my feast at Golden Corral, I'm back in my bedroom at my mom's house. Fall to my knees. I'm like, I can't do this anymore, guy. Like, what is going on here? You said you were going to take care of me. Like, what is going on here, man? I can't do this anymore. Like, kind of like I prayed a prayer with my sister before she died. I don't know why I ended up at my mom's house the day she died, but I was there. And she was in a horrible, I said, God, what are you doing to my sister? How dare you? You know, let her live or let her die. Stop this misery. I turned my back, and 30 seconds later, she took her last breath. In the same house. So there I am. Praying to God. I'm like, God, I don't know what you're doing, but I can't do this anymore. You need to show up. So then I got some cooking experience. So I hop on the old iPad I had, and I search Craigslist, you know, personal chef. Cumming, Georgia. That's where I'm living. A result pops up. I emails me back. I have that job less than 3 hours later. I started that week. And now the purpose of that job was to make 9-step amends financially to pay back my stepdad because I didn't have a job. But not only did God show up and allow me to have that job, and by the way, that's the longest position I've ever held. I just resigned from that job back in January of 10 and a half years. Not only was I able to pay back all those financial amends to all my creditors, not just my stepdad, but the way God did it was remarkable because I was taking care of somebody else's sick little sister. You know? And I was making living amends to my sister in a way, and financial amends to my stepdad. Two birds with one stone, I guess. But I had to engage in that. But it's, you know, like my grand sponsor would say, he's passed away. Passed away now. That's another thing. I never thought I'd be sober long enough to have a sponsor die. And now I've had a sponsor and a grand sponsor die. But he said, through every adversity is the seed of a new awakening. You know, so today I have to engage and participate in the spiritual life because it's all I got. There's no other option. There's no middle-of-the-road solution. To be doomed in alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. I'm the guy that people would kick me out of their house and tell me never come back. And now I have friends coming to visit me. Life has taken on a wonderful turn for the better. AA has my heart, and this is the best Christmas present I could have received, telling my story on Christmas night. Thank you for letting me be here, and thank you all.
Thank you so much. That was very, very powerful and very relatable. Thank you again. And you guys, thank you so much for coming so far in such bad weather. And Merry Christmas again to you all. And thank you for sharing your story on this night.
Strange to me, as I roam from town to town, can't put the bottle down. Right now feels like it's killing me. Life out here gets so depressing. Need something to take the edge, you see. An empty hole inside. It's the Bible, the book, or the gun for me. Seems like everyone's out.